So tonight we're going to talk about Aquinas' proof for the existence of God based on motion. So it's an important question for believers, the question of, is the faith you have that God exists rational? Is there good evidence for it? Can you give reasons for it? For people who are still not sure whether they think God exists or not, the question may be even more pressing. What can we look around and deduce from our world about whether God exists or not? So my goal in this presentation is to introduce you to a little bit about what Aquinas means by the claim that God's existence can be proven, and also to take you through the steps of one of his most well-known proofs for the existence of God, and the proof that he describes himself as the most manifest way for proving God's existence. So I'm not sure how familiar most of you are with Thomas Aquinas. So Aquinas lived from 1224 to 1275, and he was a Dominican priest and a professor at the University of Paris, which is actually one of the oldest universities in the world, founded in the 13th century. So he taught at the University of Paris, and his thought still remains important for us today. At the end of the 19th century, Pope Leo XIII actually commended all Catholics to study the thought of Aquinas, and especially philosophers and theologians, to return to his thought. So it's interesting that Aquinas' Five Ways are his most well-known piece of writing, because they occupy just a few pages in his Summa. Aquinas' Five Ways for Proving the Existence of God are probably his most well-known piece of writing. They're assigned around the country in undergraduate intro to philosophy courses. Professional philosophers have written probably thousands of pages defending the proofs and critiquing them and going back and forth about them. But the proofs themselves are just a few pages of As You Can See, which is a much larger work. And to properly understand the proofs, we've got to read them in the context of the broader work that they're a part of, and we also have to look at the historical context for the proofs as well. So it's also somewhat ironic that the Five Ways are Aquinas' most well-known arguments and ideas, because they're not even original to Aquinas himself. So Aquinas' five proofs of the existence of God are based off of Aristotle's philosophy, the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle, that is. And Aquinas wrote these proofs for an audience that would have been very familiar with Aristotle's thought. So for us today to understand those proofs, we've got to go back and try to reinterpret for us today what those concepts would have meant in their original context. So before we dive into looking at the proof itself, I want to start out with just a few qualifications that we should have in mind at the outset regarding what Aquinas thought were some limitations inherent to the project of trying to prove the existence of God. So first off, while Aquinas thought you could prove the existence of God, he didn't think every single individual human being would be able to grasp those proofs and believe in God's existence and the basis of those proofs. So he thought that some people, they just didn't have the requisite education or intellectual abilities for this way of thinking that's involved in the proof. And he also recognized that some people were far too busy with the concerns of the world, working, taking care of their families, for instance, to have the time to devote for trying to prove God's existence. And he also thought that some people were simply just kind of too lazy to do these proofs, that they'd much rather enjoy themselves than think rigorously about the question of whether God exists. But even for those who are under the ideal circumstances, they have the education, the abilities, the time, they're hardworking and ardent, he thought that even for those people who could successfully work through the proofs, they wouldn't come to, as their conclusion, everything that Christians believe about God, or even some of the most important truths that Christians believe about the nature of God. So one of the most important Christian beliefs about God is that God is triune, a Father, a Son, and a Holy Spirit. And Aquinas thought we simply couldn't know that on the basis of reason. So for example, just like me, there are many things you could never find out about me by Googling me or looking on my website or even asking my friends. There's some things about me that you could only know about me if I chose to share them with you. So inner truths about me. And so The same way for God, there's some truths about God that people can only arrive at if God chooses to freely reveal those truths to us. So Aquinas thought there were many things about the nature of God that simply weren't things that philosophers or logicians could prove. So what did Aquinas think we could prove about the existence of God or about God's nature? So Aquinas thought these five proofs from the Summa, what they showed is that in order to explain our universe, there has to be an existence right now, a first necessary being that's kind of behind it all, keeping it in existence and explaining ultimately many of the phenomena we experience about the world. So that's what the proofs get us to, in Aquinas' view. The next 25 questions of that big Summa Theologiae we saw on a few slides ago, those go on to make rational arguments to establish what this first cause would have to be like. So among other things, Aquinas argues that the first cause would have to be immaterial, unchanging, intelligent, and good. So contemporary readers often complain about the five ways. They say, well, how do you know that you've really gotten to God at the end? How do we know that this first cause is really the God of Christianity and not, you know, some necessary physical particle, for example? And that's somewhat of an unfair criticism because Aquinas meant these arguments to be a first step that's read in conjunction with the whole rest of the Summa Theologiae. So let's look now at the proof for motion and go through the steps. And at the end, I'll talk a little bit about the general strategy Aquinas takes to try to prove some of God's attributes from the conclusion he gets in the five ways. So if you got it when you came in, there's a handout as well. I wanted you to leave with something to take home. So if you haven't read anything of Aquinas before, now you have about a half a page of his writings to pore over. So I won't read out loud that whole quote, but that is his proof for motion from the Summa Theologiae. I've summarized at the bottom the main steps of the argument, and then we'll go through them one by one, and I'll try to explain for you a little bit some misunderstandings people have commonly about them, what some of the terms mean. But before doing that, I want to say again that Aquinas says this is the most manifest way for proving God. And actually, later on in another work, the Compendium Theologiae, this is the only argument he gives for the existence of God. He leaves out the other of the five ways. So this is, I think, a pretty good starting point if you haven't looked at proofs in Aquinas or in other thinkers in the Catholic tradition who try to make these proofs. So I've chosen to focus on this one because I think it's a good place to begin. So I'll read out the steps at the bottom. So the first step in his argument is just the empirical observation that there are some things in the world that are in motion. The next step is if something is moved, it is moved by another. Third, the series of movers which are moved by another cannot go on to infinity. And fourth, there must be a first mover that is moved by no other. Fifth, this mover is what everyone calls God. So now let's break these steps down. So first, when you and I hear the word motion, what we automatically think of is locomotion, moving from point A to point B, walking, taking the subway, driving our car, riding our bike. In the ancient and medieval world, the term motion was understood in a much broader sense. Motion meant any type of change. So if you look at the pictures, I have a strawberry ripening, if you can see the color change. A caterpillar turning into a butterfly, a plant's growth. These are all motions in the sense that Aquinas has in mind in terms of motion. His own example in the text is an example of heating, something moving from being cold to being hot. Now, Aquinas conceived of change in kind of a technical sort of way, but if you really break it down, it's not so technical after all. So he uses these terms, potentiality and actuality. So potentiality is a way something could be, but is not. So consider lukewarm water. There are many ways which this lukewarm water could be different than it actually is. It could be hot or cold or frozen or poured on the floor. These are its potentialities. Consider my jacket. It could be blue. It could be torn. It could be on fire, though I hope not. These are ways it's not, but they're ways it could be. So these are what ancient and medieval philosophers called potentialities of a thing. An actuality is a way something truly is in reality. So that lukewarm water we were talking about, it's lukewarm in actuality. That's how it really is, not merely a way it could be. So what is change? So Aquinas would say what it is for water to be heated, for example, is for its potentiality for heat to be realized in actuality. What it is for my jacket to be torn is for this potentiality for it to be torn to be realized in actuality. Every motion or every change is the actualization of a potentiality. It's the coming to be real or the realization of a way a thing could be but isn't in actuality. The next step in the proof is that everything which moves is moved by another. So change requires a changer. Put otherwise, nothing changes itself. When a potentiality is actualized, there has to be a cause that has the power to actualize that potential in order to explain how the change or that transition happens. So when water goes from being lukewarm to hot, there has to be something that actualizes that potential. So the water can't actualize that potential itself because the lukewarm water, it's indifferent of itself to becoming hot or to becoming cold, for example. There's nothing within it that explains why these potentialities are realized if they are. It's indifferent to either potentiality or the potentiality, if we just have one in mind, it's being realized or not. So we need something else that has that power to actually actualize and determine an object to having its potential realized. Now you might be thinking already, well, it seems like animals can realize their own potential, can move themselves. So suppose we had a dog in here. You know, it's easy to imagine that the dog would just start walking around and moving itself from one place to another. So you might say, well, that dog is actualizing its own potential to be over there or to be up here. But really, if we break a change like that down, there are all these parts within the animal body, and one part moves the other part. One part actualizes the potential of the other part and explains why it changes in the way it does. So I want to make another point that's, I think, important for understanding how the proof unfolds. So Aquinas believes that ordinary movers depend on prior causes to actualize their own potentialities so that they might in turn actualize other things. So you might have been thinking, oh, well, when water gets heated, the flame actualizes the water's potential to be hot, and that's the end of the story. We've explained heating because we said, well, the flame actualized that potential. But Aquinas says if we really think hard, it's more complicated than that. The flame itself could potentially be different than it is or even not exist at all. It's actualized by the contact of the fuel and oxygen which brings it into existence. The flame depends on these causes to be actualizing it as long as it exists. So the flame itself is a changer which is being changed by another. So it's changing the water, but it's being actualized or changed by something else. In many cases, it won't be obvious to the naked eye that the mover which actualizes a potential depends on something prior to actualize it. So consider a colored object which moves my eye to sight, or a solid object that flattens something. It may seem that color and solidity are simply actual ways something is, which aren't in turn actualized by some prior cause. However, and I'm going to read a quote from the contemporary philosopher David Odeberg. He writes, "The maintenance of solidity requires much molecular activity within the object's crystal structure, among other things. We know that having a certain color requires activities of reflection and absorption, and so on." And Thomas Joseph White, the director of the Thomistic Institute, writes, quote, "Every being we experience exists as one being altered in some way, and as one capable of further alteration." By By nature, physical objects are interactive. Every physical substance has potentialities which are being actualized by its own components or its environment. The actualization of its own potential is a precondition for any physical substance to change another. So at this point, there's two possibilities. Either the chain of changers, which are each in turn changed by something prior, goes on forever. Or the second possibility is that there's a stopping point, a first being which actualizes the potentialities of other things, but is not itself actualized or changed by anything prior to it. The next step in Aquinas' proof is to defend that an infinite regress of changed changers is impossible. Now, this step in the argument is probably the most misunderstood aspect of the proof. Aquinas' rejection of an infinite regress is often misunderstood because many people don't realize that ancient and medieval thinkers recognized two types of infinite regresses. Furthermore, Aquinas thought that only one of these types was impossible. So let's look at what these two types of infinite regresses are and get clearer about which Aquinas is rejecting in the argument. So the first type of series is what I'll call a historically or temporally ordered series. So in this series, each cause is caused to exist by a cause which existed before it in time. But each series member acts independently of the causes before it. No series member depends on the cause which produced it to cause the next member. So all of you are part of one of those type series, because human generation is an example of this kind of series. So suppose there's a guy, Mike, who fathers Jim. Jim fathers Paul. Paul fathers Luke. Luke can go on and father a son, even if Mike and Jim have passed away. So what's key in this series is that each member depends on the ones before it to exist. Luke depended on Mike and Jim existing in order for him to exist. But he doesn't depend on them once he exists to cause effects in the world. He has power through himself and through other things actualizing him in the moment to generate a son or to do other things. He doesn't need to draw on the power of all the generations before him to cause an effect. A series of dominoes is another example like that. So if we had dominoes set up here, we could flick the first one and we could sweep them away after they fall. And the ones, you know, down here, they'd still be knocking each other over. The dominoes at the end don't depend on the falling of the dominoes at the beginning. In the actual moment when they're knocking down the ones after them, they have that power to knock things down of themselves once they get hit. So what's crucial to understand regarding the proof we're looking at is that Aquinas thought that a series like this could possibly be infinite. So he actually thought that we couldn't prove on the basis of reason that our universe came into existence in time. So he thought that it was possible, speaking from the standpoint of reason, that our universe existed forever. There's no way to prove that it didn't in his mind. And that was highly debated in the Middle Ages. Saint Bonaventure actually thought you could prove from reason that the universe didn't have an infinite past, and they had a big disagreement about that. But so Aquinas thinks that even if we postulate that our world existed forever, we still need a first cause to explain why there's motion right now. So he thought you could still prove that there's a first cause, even apart from the postulation, the assumption that our world came into existence at a time in the past. So let's go on to look at the second type of infinite regress, and this is going to be the one that Aquinas says is impossible. So the second type of series I'll call a series of supporting or sustaining causes. In this series, unlike the last one, all the members in the series exist at the same time. And furthermore, each member of the series depends on all the prior causes to exercise their own causality. So every member of the series is needed to produce the final effect. So Aquinas' example of this type of series is a case of a hand that's moving a staff, that's moving a stone. So if my hand is pushing a stick that's moving a stone, if my hand stops moving, the stone stops moving as well. That intermediate cause, that staff or stick, it depends on the motion of the hand to to be moving the stone. Another more familiar example would be an example of a series of train cars. So if you're at the railroad crossing with the gates down and you see the caboose moving by, you see it's pulled by the car in front of it, which is pulled by the car in front of it, which is pulled by the car in front of it. But all of those cars depend right there in that moment on the engine to be moving in order for them to move the cars after it. So all those cars have to be moving in order for the caboose to move. So what's key in both these examples is that the members of the series are existing all at the same time, and each member of the series is contributing power that's required for the final effect to happen. So now let's see why Aquinas thought a series like this couldn't be infinite. So every member that's not first, I'll call it an intermediate member. So every intermediate member in the supporting series, it can only exercise its causality because it's sustained or supported by the causes before it. No intermediate member has power by itself to cause the final effect. So in the train example, car 7 only pulls car 8 because it's pulled by car 6. 7 can't by itself move 8, can't move anything. It depends on all the cars before it to derive power to move another car. So if a supporting or sustaining series were to be infinite, that's to say it's without a first cause, then every member of the series would be supposedly deriving its power from the ones before it, but none of those causes would have the power to cause the effect of itself. But if none has the power to cause the effect of itself, how can all the causes together cause the effect? If, for example, no train car has the power of itself to move another car, how can saying that there's an infinite series of train cars ever explain the motion of the caboose? There's no source from which the infinite number of cars would be deriving their power. So to help understand what Aquinas is saying here, I want to point out that the difference between the first cause in the series and the other causes isn't merely a difference of order. So consider an engine. An engine isn't different from the cars because it's at the front. It's not a matter of just being front in the order. The difference of the engine is that it actually has power through itself to cause motion. So first causes are intrinsically different from other causes. They don't derive their power from anything prior to them. They have power through themselves. So Aquinas' belief is that there has to be one cause like this in existence, which has power through itself to change things from potentially a certain way to actually a certain way, without being changed itself from potentially a certain way to actually a certain way. It has to have that power to make that kind of change, independent of things before it. Or else we have no ultimate source for the power to cause change in our world. If everything is depending on something before it to actualize it, in order for it to actualize other things, that is to cause other changes, we don't have any real foundation. Things are never going to get off the ground in natural processes for change to happen. So I think one challenge people have for really grasping this proof in Aquinas is it's very hard to see, in the text, the dots really aren't connected, kind of fleshing out what are the supporting or sustaining series in our world. So in the text, he gives the example of heating, that there's this change from being potentially hot to being actually hot. And then he says, the series can't go on forever. So I want to try to, just using kind of some very basic scientific theories, try to flesh out, what this might look like in reality. So consider that earlier example of water on the stove. As we discussed, the flame's power to heat depends on certain other things being actualized in a particular way. So fuel and oxygen, which could have potentially been separated, have to be actually in contact for heat and light of the flame to be actualized. And then we could look just at the oxygen, which actualizes the flame. In order for oxygen to be actualized, you need subatomic particles, you know, several of them configured with each other in a certain way to have an oxygen atom. But each of these subatomic particles, they could have possibly not been in this particular configuration. So there's got to be something further that's actualizing their potential to compose oxygen rather than another type of element. And then if we consider an individual electron, it could potentially have had a different charge. So something further is actualizing it to have the charge it does. And Aquinas' thought, I think, is that you can keep going and going. You know, our science might keep getting better and better and better. But eventually there has to be a stopping point to things that are actualized by other things that are themselves actualized by other things, or else we're going to have no explanation of why there's something rather than nothing. So why there's something there that's a physical thing that's capable of actualizing other things. We're going to need eventually something kind of outside of the physical realm that's actualizing the potentials of whatever is kind of at the rock bottom we discover in physical reality. And so this being, he says, has to be a being that's purely actual with no potentiality. So nothing prior than it is actualizing it. It's just pure actuality. So I want to emphasize, before considering some hard questions you might ask about the proof, that what Aquinas is claiming in this proof is not that we need a first cause to explain how the universe began billions of years ago. His proof is indifferent to whether the universe has a beginning or not. He's not trying to explain how everything began a long time ago in the past. He actually says in another work that the proof from motion would still prove the existence of God, even if the universe itself were without beginning. So his thought is that even if the universe existed forever, right here, right now, we have motion. And in order to explain how all those changes involved in motion are possible, we need a first cause that's pure actuality. So right here and now, grass is growing, a caterpillar is crawling, a flame is burning something. And as we've seen, the agents that are immediately bringing about those changes in nature depend on prior things changing them to be a certain way, and they could have not been this way. We need some explanation for why they actually are the way they are. In the series of things that depend on prior things, it can't go on forever in Aquinas' view. As we've seen, we'd be left without an ultimate source of power if that were to go on forever. So there has to be a first being which could not have been potentially otherwise. So naturally, the hard question you might want to ask at this point is, well, how do we know the first cause is God? Could the first cause be some yet undiscovered physical reality? Some physical reality that is kind of the rock bottom of reality that's explaining why everything else is changing and actual the way it is right now. So recall that to be first, the first cause can't be actualized by anything prior to it. It can't depend on something prior to explain the way it actually is. So in Aquinas' view, the physical world is defined as the world of motion. So what physical objects are, in Aquinas' view, are just the group of objects that act and react with one another through change. So if we conclude that the first cause can't be actualized by another in any way, then it follows that the first cause has to be outside of the physical world. It has to transcend physicality. Now, Aquinas gives another argument further on in the Summa to show that the first cause can't be physical. So kind of an additional argument here. His proof goes like this. He says, everything which has parts depends on its parts to exist. The first cause, of course, by definition, can't depend on other things, or else whatever it depends on would really be first. So if everything that has parts depends on its parts, then the first cause can't have parts, or else those parts would really be the rock bottom of reality. But Aquinas reasons that all material objects have parts, so therefore the first cause can't be material. It's part of the nature of material things that they have parts to them. So still, okay, if you're convinced by that, that all right, whatever this first cause is, it has to be some transphysical thing that's not like ordinary physical objects, something that doesn't have parts, something that, you know, isn't located in the physical realm, interacting with other objects. Still, how do we know that this cause is God? Maybe it's some kind of just immaterial first being. As I mentioned earlier, you know, probably what we've seen so far doesn't rule out that possibility, because it's only later in the Summa that Aquinas proves that the first cause has to have the attributes traditionally associated with God. So I can try to give you just like a very brief sketch of the strategy he takes and all of those questions so you can kind of see like where he's going. But it would take obviously a lot more time and attention to detail to fully unpack all of this. So what Aquinas does is he analyzes what's involved in being a first cause. So obviously a first cause by definition can't depend on anything else. So he kind of goes through and reasons what follows about the nature of a being that's purely independent and purely actual. So the first cause, it can't be brought into existence, or else whatever brought it into existence would be first. So the first cause has to exist necessarily, can't go in or out of existence. Furthermore, Aquinas reasons that the first cause has to be outside of time. So as he sees it, what time is just the measure of motion. When we think about the passage of time, really what's going on is it's our minds numbering and counting before and after and changes. So since the first cause doesn't undergo any change or motion, the first cause isn't something we can measure by time. Further on, he reasons that the first cause has to be intellectual. It has to be a being with knowledge. And this would take a lot of work to kind of see why he thinks this is, because it follows from a view he holds that's not so familiar to people today in contemporary philosophy. His thought is that immateriality is the principle of knowledge. So anything that's immaterial is automatically a being with intellect, with knowledge, because immateriality is basically what gives rise to comprehending something in an intentional way. So in the next 25 questions, Aquinas goes through these points and many others and unpacks them and looks at objections to them. So what we've seen in the first way is just only intended to get the conclusion that there's some first rock bottom, pure actual being that is the precondition of change in natural processes in our world. And it's only further on through a lot of reasoning that he tries to show that that being has to have many of the attributes in common that Christians and Muslims and Jews believe belong to the God of Revelation. So his conclusion is that through careful reasoning, people who give them enough time, have enough ability, and have the right amount of leisure to think about these things in depth can, on the basis of reason, come to the conclusion that the ultimate source and ground of reality is a being that has many attributes in common with the God of Christianity. So I think I'll stop there and save some time for questions. So Aquinas, and this is one of the very difficult part of this thought, a lot of controversy among scholars about how to understand it. Aquinas says that me, through my will, I cooperate with God, that we work together to actualize my active will. So God is responsible for my will being actually really something rather than nothing. But I play a role in specifying the object that my will is directed towards, because we have a freedom of specifying. So let's say I walk in an ice cream shop, we'll keep it to a simple, non-controversial example, and I have to pick between chocolate and vanilla. So when I walk in, I'm not willing anything, and I see the ice cream, then I have to decide is it chocolate or vanilla. God is the explanation for how my will goes from willing nothing to willing something, but I am cooperating at the same time in terms of that as chocolate rather than vanilla. But many people after Aquinas rejected the proof because they rejected that everything that's moved is moved by another. So Henry of Dent, his generation after Aquinas, and John Duns Scotus, they wanted to give our will and some natural acts as well a power to change themselves. And the Thomists, they fought back. They said, well, that doesn't make any sense. If my will is in a state of potency, it's not willing anything. How does it move itself? Because the move itself, it has to be willing something. But we just said it's in a state of potency, so we've got a kind of contradiction that it is and isn't willing something at once. So the Thomists said, you know, well, really, it's hard to work out how this works, the cooperation we've got between God and us, but we have to affirm it just to make sense logically with how our will is goes from not willing to willing. A great question.
Is there another question? Are there any other questions? Well, I was wondering why this cycle has to form a redress instead of just one thing causing the cause itself. So, for instance, if you have a hot object and a cold object, it seems the hot one makes the cold one hotter, the cold one makes the hot one hotter, the colder. And that just forms a circle rather than an infinite redress.
Yeah, so the point is actually in some of the works ask the question of whether you can do like a loop. And so his thought is that with the loop, we'll just say you've got A, B, C, and D. So A causes B, B causes C, and then D causes A. So for A to cause B, a condition is that D causes A. But a condition of D causing A is A causing B, C, and D. So then you run into this problem that in order for D to cause A, A's got to like cause the other side of the loop. But then in order for A to cause that loop, it's like the loop R needs to be completed for D to cause it. So things are going to run into kind of this problem of, A's going to be depending on D, but D's going to depend on A, so nothing. Get off the ground and then with that. Another great question. That is a great question. You hit on a really important problem or discussion that people were talking about in the past. And they're pretty good guides of what were kind of the hard things with these issues that they were grappling with at the time. Yeah.
I guess I'm just confused as to if he believes that one type of the infinite regression is possible, how then he says, okay, we're going to still prove God exists.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just confused like that then.
Yeah, but that's a challenging part of this. And I think part of it's challenging too, because there are so many people today that are trying to prove God, but theirs are trying to disprove that the world goes back infinitely in time. But so what he's saying is this. So let's say right now I'm raising my arm right now. Whether the world existed forever, or whether it came into existence, whenever scientists said it did, billions of years ago. So I'm raising my arm right now, whether or not the world existed forever or had a beginning. And Aquinas thinks the way he's trying to prove God here is because you need God to explain why I'm raising my arm right now. So you could tell a story, you could say, well, I'm raising my arm and there's neurons firing, there's tendons, there's bones. And we can keep tracing the causes, but they're all happening right here in this but eventually we need to stop and point. And you're writing this freely, so my will is kind of a starting point where this all happens. And eventually you've got to explain, well, why did my will go from not able to do this to actually willing to do it? You know, with a case of fire, you can break it down. There's oxygen, there's fuel, there's reasons and oxygen, and so on. Eventually, right there in that moment, you're going to need to hit a rock bottom, something that's not actualized, or being caused to do what it's doing by something more basic.
And so it's like that, like the cause, like you might end up with a cause that was a cause to like something like in the past.
Yeah, so it's like the whole proof works. Leading the past, it doesn't matter what happens in the past. It's all about causes that are operating in the present in an individual case of change and emotion. Yeah.
Okay, so just to follow up on that, if you have some sort of a column chain, a chain of causes, necessarily the emotion applies, but there's some time, even if it's like in the limit in a very small amount, at what point do you sort of find out it's present, you know, this is a chain of causes being present in the present, whereas working it back, you know, you get the potential to
be present. Yeah, well, that's great. And in the theory of relativity, it comes in here. I'm not a physics person, but some people who try to defend this proof and try to show how it interplays with theory of relativity and, you know, really fleshing out in terms of our best scientific theories, you know, what we mean by things that are simultaneous. And it makes me not being a science person. I say, you know, is there a way we can define it maybe apart from looking at time? So just that, like, yeah, I don't know how it would go, actually. So I was thinking maybe there's a way to talk about it without making reference to time, and it's just simultaneous, and there proofs back in. But yeah, I guess maybe one way could say it is that the completion of one actualization of potentiality isn't prior to, it's not over before the actualization of potentiality of another. So I guess maybe the beginning is going to be slightly staggered, but not as complete before the other ones. Good question.
I'm wondering that if the two types of causal sequence that you mentioned, that, are they sort of mutually exclusive in the sense that one which is a temporal series, causation in temporal series, is necessarily a different sort of causation that we're talking about? Or are these really two perspectives from two fundamentally different, deeply different ontological viewpoints? One being sort of one in which causation is basically a kind of later view in which sort of being is univocal, versus an earlier one in which you have a participative notion of being, and causation then doesn't have to have a sort of zero-sum concurrent thing in which, you know, either it's myself or God, sort of, or you have two people, you know, two horses pulling the barge and it's one or the other. I'm not, you know, my question is whether you don't actually need to have that kind of older Neoplatonic conception. And if that's true, it has a lot to say about our access, rational access to this. I'm not sure I can go with you in presuming that Aquinas thought exactly that a demonstration in this regard, a proof, right, was meant to convince somebody from totally outside that conception of being, right?
Yeah.
There's a kind of anachronism in this, and I'm not sure it's been very helpful. Having struggled with this through sort of analytic philosophy as well, there's a certain kind of sterility about this sort of discussion, right, prior to dealing with this sort of larger issue. I wonder if you could address that.
Yeah, no, there are a lot of great, very deep insights in the comment. Yeah, there are a few things you said that I could say a little bit about. So we'll kind of go backwards. The last thing you said was just about the anachronism, like was Aquinas trying to convince people but didn't share a lot of these fundamental assumptions that he did about being and participation and analogy. And I mean, you're absolutely right. In Aquinas, the Summa Theologiae, we talk about it today as a theology manual for beginners. But the beginners he was actually writing it for were beginners and master of theology. So people who had studied a lot of Aristotle were preparing to be theology professors. So that's who he's writing for, you know, Christians, priests in the University of Paris preparing to be theology teachers. He's not like going out and trying to write it to people who, you know, don't believe in God or who don't you know, share a lot of background metaphysics. I mean, he does the question, can God's existence be demonstrated? So he definitely, I think, thinks that these are demonstrations in a logical sense. But they presuppose, as you're pointing out, a lot of shared assumptions about metaphysics. So I also thought that was a good point you had about causality. So I don't know how many of you study philosophy and contemporary philosophy, but so contemporary philosophy and reflections on causation are very much shaped by the thought of David Hume, an early modern figure. And so Hume defines causes as that those which perceive their effects in time. So most contemporary philosophers, the way they're defining causation, start with how to recognize these kind of theories of supporting and sustaining, because in the ancient medieval world, causation is thought of as ontological dependence. And that's what he's talking about here, not, you know, logical entailment of things or before and after. So I think what you're pointing at is that, you know, to really go out and convince people who've been kind of, I don't know if I want to say tainted, but influenced by contemporary philosophy, you have to argue a lot of the foundational assumptions about what is causation. And I think science can be very helpful because scientists recognize, you know, forms of causation that, you know, contemporary philosophers, the way they define causation, aren't going to really count. So looking at kind of the empirical world, I think, would be a way of getting, you know, back to that idea that there's a sustaining and supporting series ontologically. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about movers on the little and the solution to science God. It seems like a little different from the other examples of things in actuality, producing actuality, and the hot thing making the cold thing hot. Seems like,
yeah.
How does that, how does ice cream make you choose to talk about that?
Yeah, so Aquinas following Aristotle recognize that there are two types of causes, natural causes and rational causes. And natural causes are causes where their potentialities can only be actualized in one determinate way. So hot, it only heats things, hot, some kind of cool things. But then there are these rational causes. And Aquinas' view, you know, our reason would be one of those causes, and our will can be actualized in different ways. They're open to alternatives. And so with those causes, Aquinas wants to say, I think, with the will, that, you know, our will plays a role in deciding which of the two alternatives it goes, it's actualized, it's choosing. But just like every other cause, we need God to explain that transition from potency to act, from, you know, potentially being able to choose something but not actually doing it, but actually doing it. And Thomas has been debating this fight for centuries about how he really fleshed this out. You know, some have said, and perhaps guys have even more wise ones, that there's kind of a thing here, you know, every familiar kind of cause we understand is based on our experience, and God transcends the physical world. The way he's going to cause things is very different than anything you can imagine. So it's really hard to pin this down in a precise way from how it's happening in the will, while it's also playing a His doctoral dissertation and award for this were just republished in the kind of legacy volume about 20 bucks in the Amazon. It's called Grace and the Operative Freedom for Operative Grace. Do you have a thought on
that?
Something like that. But if you, I can email you some suggestions for a little bit of time to think about. I might give you some better ones too. And a challenge to some of these are that they're kind of steep in all these debates and can get a little technical, but maybe I can come up, see if I can come across some that's more kind of overview, but definitely a very important issue and a hard one. Yeah.
Just a basic question. The first few words you explained is the material I believe and it's a philosophy in here. Maybe more of a background of that thought.
Yeah.
Personal book.
Yeah, so like what it means to be material?
Yes.
Yeah. So this is a. So I mean, obviously, we have a lot of pop culture that uses an image of materiality. So when I teach philosophy to human person and think about schools, I show my students a little clip from the movie Ghost. You get like, you know, the see-through Patrick Swayze who's like floating through things. And so even our minds are very good at imagining what material things are. But Aquinas, what he pretty much how he understands all these divine attributes is in a negative way. So all we can know about an immaterial thing is that it's not material. It's not located at a place, because what is located as a place is that the physical boundaries of an object are contiguous with some other body, but an immaterial thing doesn't have physical boundaries, so it can't be at a place. It can't have parts, it can't have mass, it can't cause things the way, you know, I can't cause this by following up and exerting force. So we can't understand what it is positively, but we can negate and know what it's not. And it's, so sometimes people are like, well, what does that really tell you, just knowing what something is not? But it can kind of save us from getting things wrong. Like sometimes we can think of problems, or like, how does this or that work? And then if we stop and go back, sometimes we realize we assume a material feature, assume a material thing, and that can sometimes be the root of some, you know, difficulties in understanding things. So one question that people always ask, if you say God is a material, and that means God is, has a place, well, how is God present to everything then? And Aquinas tries to explain that through causality, that the way God is present isn't the way, like, maybe a gas permeating a room, but how sustaining and causing the whole thing, everything being, the way his proof suggests. Good question.
Yeah. Amazing one as well. Years ago, I asked a follower, I said, how do you know God exists? And he said to me, he said years ago, I come to the room, maybe something simple. He said,